ॐ सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति 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 नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नारायण नरं चैव नरोत्तमं नरं चैव देवीं सरस्वतीं चैव देवीं ततो जयमुदीरयेत् ततो पितामहार्यं प्रवदन्ति षष्ठं पितामहार्यं महर्षिमक्षयविभूतियुक्तं महर्षिम् नारायणस्यां च जमेकपुत्रं नारायण त्वैपायनं वेदनदिं नमामि त्वैपायनं वेदनदिं नमामि. Very good. So we continue with our current chapter. We're seeing a lot of wonderful metaphors in these chapters, drishtantas. In the prior class, we had seen a drishtanta of that river of life, very threatening, violent river of life sweeping us along. And today we'll proceed. There's another nice metaphor coming right at the very beginning. It's a very typical teaching style in Vedanta, not just in Vedanta, but in general, to use pictures in the form of words. As we mentioned in the last class, picture is worth 1,000 words, so you can create a picture using words. Technically, it's a metaphor, an analogy. In Sanskrit, we call it a drishtanta. And for every drishtanta, there's a darshtanta. Drishtanta is the analogy. Darshtanta is that which is being represented. So we will continue with another nice drishtanta, which is coming to the essence of what the whole chapter is about. The whole chapter is really about self-control and detachment. And you'll see how that comes in the current verse. This verse has three lines. Bhumishthani va bhutani, bhumishthani va bhu, parvatastho nishamaya, parvatastho, akrudhyanna prahrashyanscha, akrudhyanna prahrash, nanrisham samatistata, nanrisham satatist. Very nice image. Suppose you are Parvata Staha. You are standing on top of a mountain. And from your vantage point, standing on top of the mountain, you look at Bhumishthani Iva Bhutani. You see all the Bhutani, all the creatures who are Bhumishthani, who are down there on the ground. You're standing up on the mountaintop, looking down at all these people down on the ground. Nishamaya. Is a verb. Please look at. Imagine yourself being on top of the mountain, looking down at all. Have you ever been up high and you see they all look like these little ants? They look very tiny from your vantage point up on them. But now, how should you look at them? What should be your attitude? Remember, this whole chapter is on detachment. So the attitude that you should look upon them with is akrudhyan, without any enmity in your heart, without any malice in your heart. Aprahrishyanscha, but also without any elation in your heart. It's detachment. No malice in your heart, no ill feelings in your heart, nor any prahrishyanscha, means nor being elated by what you see. Sometimes when you see in a crowd of people, you see someone you know, aha. So here it says, without any of that. Na anrishamsa, na amrishamsa, without any anger, any negative feelings. So having no positive feelings nor negative feelings towards all those that you look. With this matihi, with this attitude, tata, in that manner, you look at all these people. And we would say, you look at all these people objectively. They're neither friends nor foes. They're just people. Now, there's a point being taught here, which will come out in the final verse. Before we see that, just to reflect for a moment, when we look upon people as, you know, you'd say, mera jan, my people, my family, mera log, the people who are close to me. If there are some who are mine, then there are so many others who are not mine. If you're mine, you're one of us. If you're not mine, you become enemy. And this turns out to be a common problem for humanity in general, in that we categorize people into friend and foe. I mean, there's nothing in between? And that's part of the message of this verse. People are people. You know, your friends will support you as much as they can. There will be times when they can't. That's life. In the same way, the people who you consider to be foes, they might be pretty good people. There's just some issue that causes them. There's some reason for them to behave in that way. This is a big topic. I don't think we'll get off on a huge tangent here. We could spend the rest of our class talking about this. So here, the message is to look upon all these people objectively, standing from your perspective up on top of the mountaintop. What will you get out of this? To look with objectivity on all those people standing on the top of the mountain, looking down at all of them on the ground. Tataha, from this, drakshasi, you will see, bhutanam sarvesham, of all those people there on the ground, sarvesham, all of them, all of those bhutas, all of those people standing on the ground. What will you see? Drakshasi, you will see there. You will see prabhava and apyaya. You will see their prabhava and apyaya. You will see their origin and destruction. You'll see their birth and death, or to use common English, we'll see them come and go. To see them come and go means to see the span of their lifetime. This is a metaphor. Standing up on top of the mountain doesn't mean literally you should go find a mountain, climb up to the top, bring your binoculars so that you can see all those tiny little people down. This is a metaphor. So what is the point of the metaphor is to assume a perspective in which you are removed, and not just removed, but when you're at a high enough level, you see such a vast span in front of you. You've all been perhaps on a mountain or up in an airplane, and when you have that elevation, you see such a wide span of land before you. But here, metaphorically, is to see not a wide span of land, but the wide span of life. From birth to death. This is a very important perspective. Generally, our time span that we see is, well, right now, 1 hour. The length of this class. So we're focused on the 1 hour length of this class. Or maybe we back off a little bit. We're focused on this day, what we're going to do from morning to evening in this day. Maybe you've got a busy week next week and you're focused on what you have to do next week. But whatever it is, our vision about life is fairly narrow. We're focused on the day, we're focused on the week. And the defect of that is we fail to appreciate the whole span of life, which is shorter than we would like to admit. You know, while we're so focused on today, we don't think about the fact that we have a limited number of days to live on this planet. We don't think like that. We're focused on today. Being on top of the mountain here represents getting that broad view of life, the span of life, prabhava apyaya, from birth to death, so that you can see how short it is. You'll have to forgive me. I have to share a joke. I think it's a common joke, but I've heard it from my guru several times, so I associated with him. And he remarks that when you see in a graveyard, you see the gravestone, It gives a name, so-and-so. And then it gives the dates, the date of their birth, 1942-2010. And he explains, that dash really tells you what life is about. You're born in 1942, and then you dash to your death. Born, and you dash to the death. Very interesting observation. And very true. But you won't get that perspective when you're caught up in day-to-day activities. Being on top of the mountain is a metaphor to get the big view of our life, the broad perspective of our lives, of our own lives. So your own birth date, in my case, 1953, dash, then what? It's coming. So the dash is already there. I'm already dashing. Good. Our eyes should be open to this reality. That's what this verse says with this very beautiful metaphor of standing on top of the mountainside, seeing the span of our lives. Very nice poetry. Evam vai sarva dharmebhyo, evam vai sarva dharmebhyo, vishishtam meni re buddhaha, vishishtam meni re dharmam dharma bratam shreshto, dharmam dharma bratam munayas tattva darshinaha, munayas tattva darshinaha. And this verse sums up a lot of what we've already been seeing here. Evam, thus, vai, indeed, sarva dharmebhyaha vishishtam. That which is vishishtam, that which is exalted, that which is best, sarva dharmebhyaha, among all dharmas, among all spiritual teachings, vishishtam, that which is best among all spiritual teachings, buddhaha menire, wise ones, buddhaha, the wise ones, menire, they consider, they reflect on what is the best spiritual teaching to guide our lives. This is really summarizing or concluding the chapter. We'll conclude the chapter today, I'm sure. To reflect on how to live your life. Sarva dharmebhyaha vishishtaha. What is the best way to live your life? It's a paraphrase, but it gives you the sense of it. What is the best way to live your life? Menire buddhaha. Wise ones reflect on this. Who are those ones? In the second line, those who are munayaha, munis, wise ones. Muni can also mean sannyasis, those who have withdrawn from daily life and live an exclusively spiritual life. So munayaha, those wise ones, those sannyasis, those introspective ones. Muni also can mean someone who practices mauna, someone who doesn't talk much. The idea is that someone who doesn't talk much thinks more. The converse is really obvious. Someone who's always talking, people like this, someone who's always talking, nothing is going on, and just their mouth is flapping, but they don't think much. In order to think, we should be quiet and reflect. So muni, mananashila, someone who's given to thinking, reflection, someone who's a little bit more quiet and introspective, those who are tattva darshinaha, those who can have discovered reality. They are darshins. They have seen. They have seen what is tattva, what is true, what is real. They have discovered the reality of life. Those ones are buddhaha, enlightened, wise, learned, and they, menire, they think about such things. Most people don't think about such things. These people are thinking about sarva dharmebhyaha vishishtam. What is the best way to live? They're thinking about what is shreshtaha, what is best, dharma bhratam dharmam. What is a shreshta dharma? What is the best dharma for dharma bhratam, for those who abide with dharma, for those who follow dharma, What is the best dharma? And here dharma has a very loose meaning. We're talking about life, attitude towards life. So these wise people think about what is the meaning of life, what is the purpose of life, what is the best way to live one's life. Buddhaha menire. These wise ones think about it. Do most people think about this? What do most people think about? Most people think about, I wonder what's on TV tonight. God! Or, what's for dinner? Or, what is the latest movie? Or, whatever it is. And I don't want to sound smug, because we all have our limitations. I have my limitations. But what most people think about is incredibly trivial. The little minutiae of life, thinking about dinner, thinking about TV, thinking about movies. Can you imagine? We're dashing to light, we're dashing to our death, having been born, we're all dashing right now. And what are we thinking about while we're dashing? What's for dinner? So if we're well fed, then we can dash more quickly. How silly is this? But Buddhaha, wise people, menire, they reflect on what this life is about. What is the purpose of life? What is shreshta? What is most important in this life? To ask these questions is absolutely vital. To me, the scariest thing in life, I'll admit this, the scariest thing to me would be to come to my last day of life realizing that I blew it, that I failed to live a full and complete life, that I failed in spiritual pursuit, I failed to be loving and caring and compassionate, I failed to take this opportunity of life and live it to its fullest. The scariest thing to me would be to arrive at the last day of my life with that recognition. But for all of us seated here, it won't happen. Why? We are right now reflecting on what this life is about, what is the purpose and goal of life. This is the kind of reflection and understanding that gives shape, meaning, purpose, depth to our lives, makes our lives meaningful. All right. So if you live a reflective life following these teachings, what is the sarva dharmanam shreshta? What is the best of vishishtam, the best of all teachings? The best of all teachings is what we're studying. So Vyasa, remember the context, Vyasa is giving this instruction to his son, Shuka. And so when Vyasa says the best of all teachings, he's referring to what he's teaching right now. So this is a message. What is being taught in this whole Mahabharata, or in this whole Moksha Dharma Parva, or in this whole, 24-chapter dialogue between Vyasa and Shuka? This is what is best. This is what is to be understood. And what does that culminate in? These teachings of Vedanta that we find in the Mahabharata, what do they culminate in? Atmajnana, self-knowledge, enlightenment. We'll see that in the next verse. Atmano vyavinho jnatva, atmano vyayinho jnatva, idam putranushasanam, idam putranusha. Prayataya pravaktavyam, prayataya hitaya nugataya cha, hitaya. Atmanaha avyayinaha jnatva. Jnatva idam. Jnatva, having known, having discovered idam, this what? Anushasanam, this teaching. Putra, O son, as Vyasa addresses his son, Putra, O son, Jnatva, having understood idam anushasanam, this teaching, what I'm wondering, did you ever get one of those lectures from your father? He goes on and on and on and on and on. And then at the end, he finally says, you know, all of this that I've been telling you has been really, really important. You better remember it. That's sort of what's happening at this point. So as Vyasa comes to the end of his instruction to his son, Putra, O son, idam anushasanam, this particular teaching, jnatva, understanding this teaching about what? Atmanaha, about the truth of yourself, which is avyayinaha, avyaya. That which doesn't have vyaya is avyayin. Vyaya means decay, that which wanes away. The process of waning or wearing away is vyaya. Here, atma is described as avyaya, that which doesn't decay, that which doesn't wane away. Wait a minute. We just talked about born dash death. Well, true. Body is wearing away rapidly, as we know very well. Our bodies are wearing away. Other aspects of our lives are wearing away. In some cases, wealth is wearing away. That happens. In some cases, comfort, security wears away. Things change. In life, everything changes. Things come, things go. That's all vyaya. On the other hand, atma, the true self, is avyaya. That which doesn't decay, that which doesn't wane, is that atma, which is the consciousness behind your mind, behind your thoughts. This goes back to that mountaintop perspective. Up on the mountaintop, you're not affected by everything that goes on below you. In a similar way, consciousness, Chaitanya Atma, the true self, which is pure consciousness, is utterly unaffected as the body decays, as the mind goes. The best way of describing most minds is this roller coaster. So there are some days where you're up, some days that you're down, and you keep alternating between the two of these. Well, your body can also have a little bit of a roller coaster. There are some days you feel better, there are some days you don't feel better, but eventually the roller coaster goes down in the long run. So the body is doing its roller coaster thing, your mind is doing its roller coaster thing, your emotions, and your consciousness, utterly independent, absolutely unaffected. Atmanaha avyayanaha. For that atma, which is unchanging, which is utterly unaffected by whatever happens to your body and mind, jnatva, having understood idam anushasanam, this teaching about that atma, then having understood this, pravaktavyam, then it should be told, it should be taught. It should be taught to whom? So who has understood this? Vyasa. Vyasa says, I, having understood these teachings about Atma being unchanging, unaffected by anything, therefore Vyasa says, pravaktavyam, it should be taught, and he is teaching it. Who's he teaching it to? His son, Putra, Ashoka. And he's teaching it to the one who is prayataya. It should, pravaktavyam, this teaching should be taught unto whom? Prayataya, unto one who's making a proper effort. Proper effort would mean, in a lecture, would mean paying attention, right? Can you imagine if someone's not listening? Can you imagine if Vyasa's son, Shuka, is not paying attention? It's just a funny memory. Many years ago, I was invited to give some lectures at Stroudsburg University. When I was living in Pennsylvania at the ashram, so the Stroudsburg was the nearest town, and they have a small university there. So I was asked to give some lectures on Vedanta or Hindu philosophy to an undergraduate class in philosophy. like philosophy 101 or whatever was the course. So these undergraduates are there. They're all, what, maybe 18, 19 years of age. And it's a big hall, maybe 100 of them are gathered there. And so I started giving this lecture. And I look around the room, not a single one of them are making eye contact with me. You know, they're either looking at some, you know, flipping through a magazine, looking at the ceiling, flipping a pencil. God, I don't know. You know, I have great respect for anyone who teaches in grade school, high school, undergraduates, to teach young. I think graduate students, at least I'm sure that's quite different. But teaching little children, you have all the discipline problems. Teenagers, high school, gosh, I can't imagine. And even undergraduates, not much different. So here, Vyasa says that these teachings should be given prayataya, unto those who are making an effort, specifically those who are paying attention. I never went back to teach those undergraduates again. It's not for me. It doesn't work. So you should teach those who are prayataya, making an effort, paying attention. It should be taught to those who are hitaya, good people. People who have good hearts, people who have good conduct, and also anugataya. This sounds like a father speaking. Anugata means obedient. So this should be taught to, specifically to a son who is prayata, who makes an effort, who pays attention, who is hitta, who is a good person, and who is anugata, obedient. These teachings should be given. And then, atma jnanam idam guhyam, sarva guhyatamam mahata, sarva guhyatamam abruvantaraham tata, abruvam taraham tha atma sakshikam anjasa atma sakshikam. Start in the second line. Abruvam yat aham tata. Tata, O dear one, Vyasa addresses his son. O dear one, aham abruvam. Aham, I, abruvam. I said, I just taught you, tat yat, that which I taught you, that which I've just taught you, we're coming towards the end of the chapter, that which I've just taught you, what is that? Now go back to the first line, atmajnanam idam, this teaching, which is about atmajnanam, knowledge of your true self, knowledge of that which is utterly unaffected. The body is decaying, the mind is going up and down on the roller coaster, but the consciousness, which is your essential nature, utterly unaffected. Idam atmajnanam, this self-knowledge. Aham abruvam, I have just taught you this self-knowledge. What about that self-knowledge? Idam guhyam, this is a secret. Secret. There's something interesting here. Idam guhyam, secret. Not just a secret. Sarva guhya tamam. It is the most secret of all secrets. It is the most secret of all secrets, and it's mahat. It's so important. It's the greatest and most hidden secret of all secrets. Now, the common idea of secret is absolutely silly and inappropriate in this context. Secret means when somebody tells you something in confidence about somebody else, right? That's our common concept of a secret. You know, I just heard this about her. Please don't tell. This is how rumors and gossip. This, God save us from these kinds of secrets. Atmajnanam is that kind of secret? Don't tell anyone. What in the world? And we find the same language in the Bhagavad Gita. where Sri Krishna himself says, Guhyatamam, this is the most secret of all secrets. Why? Secret means you shouldn't tell it. The prior verse just says, pravaktavyam, it should be taught. Make up your mind. So we have to understand that the meaning of guhyam in ancient India is different than our concept of secret today. Guhya, that which is in a guha, is guhya. That which is in a cave. The idea is hidden. We commonly translate guhya as secret, but its better meaning, and especially in this context, is hidden. That which is hidden. Idam atmajnanam, this self-knowledge, is guhyam, hidden. Now it makes sense. And it is guhyatamam, sarva guhyatamam. It is the most hidden of all things that are hidden. How can it be the most hidden of all? Hidden, we understand. But most hidden of all is just a nice modern metaphor. The idea is, if something is hidden in your closet, you understand that. But imagine something being hidden in clear sight. Hidden, what is that? The term they use, hidden in plain sight. This is a term they use when they're talking about bin Laden hiding out in his town in Pakistan. So bin Laden hiding out in this town, hidden in plain sight. So just a mile from the military academy is this big mansion, big fence, hidden in plain sight. That's very clever. Hidden in plain sight. Something hidden in your closet is one thing, but when your glasses are lost and you've spent 20 minutes looking in your closet for your lost glasses, your glasses are more hidden than something hidden in your closet because your glasses are hidden in plain sight. Bin Laden, I keep doing that. Obama and Osama, this is a... Bhagavan is having a nice joke on us, mixing us up. So, Bin Laden was very clever, and perhaps he even chose to be so close to the military academy for that very reason of hiding in plain sight, because that which is hidden in plain sight is the hardest to find. If it's lost someplace in your closet, you'll eventually find it. But if it's hidden in plain sight, you may continue to overlook it. Satchidananda Atma is exactly like that, hidden in plain sight. We spend all time looking in closets, so to speak, trying to discover what is Satchidananda Atma, where is it, what is it, how is it, etc. And the remarkable fact is, hidden in plain sight in this sense, the Atma you seek is present here now in this very experience. Hidden in plain sight. How is it hidden? We just said moments ago, Atma is consciousness. The consciousness present in this experience. And it's hidden because you think this consciousness is just ordinary consciousness. But the rishis discovered that it's not so. The rishis discover that what you think is ordinary consciousness is actually Satchidananda Atma, which, as we're going to see in the next verse, is non-different than Brahman, the reality of the cosmos. You think it's ordinary consciousness, therefore you treat it lightly, ignore it, overlook it as being possibly something of much, much greater importance. This is what it means to be hidden in plain sight, hidden in this experience. hidden in this experience as consciousness itself. Aham abruvam. I just told you, O Tata, O son, I've just told you this truth about Atmajnanam, the truth of oneself, which is the most secret of all secrets. It is mahat, it is great. Atma sakshikam. It is Atma, which is Sakshi, the conscious observer of all thoughts, emotions, perceptions, all mental events, that Sakshi. I've just told you this. That which is most hidden, in the first line he says, that which is most hidden, aham abruvam, I've just told you, anjasa. Very simply, very directly, very clearly. That which is hidden in plain sight, when you finally get it, it's so obvious. You know, when you finally discover that your glasses are not in that closet someplace, they're right here, parked on your head, when you finally get it, it's so obvious. In the same way here, when these teachings of Vedanta make you discover that you are, you know, just use my guru's words, he says it very nicely, you already have what you want to possess. You already are what you want to become. And when these teachings make you discover it, it's just so obvious. It's been there all the time. Anjasa, this is taught very directly, very simply. So that which is the most hidden of all, because it's hidden in plain sight, this can be taught. Anjasa, very directly, very immediately. Then, concluding this topic, naiva strina pumane tan, naiva strina pumane tan, naiva chedam napum sakam, naiva chedam napum sakam, aduhkamasukham brahma, aduhkamasukham brahm, bhuta bhavya bhavatmakam, bhuta bhavya bhavatmakam. So that Atma, prior line, aham abruvam, I've just told you, O son, I've just told you this Atma Jnanam, this teaching about your true nature, about Atma. Atma, which is, now that Atma is described here, Atma na eva stri na puman. That Atma, which is neither female nor male. This is such a very clear and powerful teaching. What do we mean by Atma? What do we mean by consciousness? Is your consciousness male or female? That is really an interesting observation. Body is male or female. In fact, there's a third option. Na stri, na puman, na idam, na pumsakam, neuter. So, these three genders, male, female, neuter. Neuter, perhaps, well, perhaps part of culture, but we should make a... There are two aspects. One is in Sanskrit grammar, nouns and pronouns are either male, female, or neuter. But even in life, there are people who fit into normal male categories, people who fit into normal female categories, and people who don't fit well into either. And allow me just to make a brief editorial comment. You know, there's a lot of debate nowadays about homosexuality, about transgender, about all these non-conventional expressions of gender and sexuality. This occurrence of this word, napumsakam, in this verse, really shows you something about ancient India. They understood that it's part of life. It happens. You don't, it's not a matter for judgment. It's just part of life. There are some people who don't fit into these categories of male or female. And the fact that it occurs here in this verse shows it's just an ordinary part of life just to be acknowledged. It's not good. It's not bad. It just happens. So this is what, just to give you a little insight into how these topics were understood in ancient India. They weren't glorified, nor were they criminalized. They were just considered as normal aspects of life. Anyway, enough said. So, that Atma, Atma meaning your consciousness. na stri, na puman, na napumsakam. Your consciousness is not male. Your consciousness is not female. Your consciousness is not even neuter. That means a gender not fitting into either of those two. Means your consciousness is genderless. Gender belongs to your body. To some extent, gender belongs to your mind, to your personality. But how clear it is that consciousness is that which reveals your mind, your thoughts, your personality. It's the consciousness behind the gender, and the consciousness which is itself genderless. Not only is it genderless, a dukkham. It doesn't get sad, a sukham, nor does it get happy. Your consciousness is not only genderless, but it's not even subject to that roller coaster of happiness and sadness, happiness and sadness. The consciousness we're talking about is that which reveals happiness and sadness. How would you know you're happy or sad if it weren't for consciousness? And further, this is a little technical but an important point, just to establish that your consciousness doesn't become happy or sad. Suppose, many people think that when your mind becomes happy, consciousness also becomes happy. When your mind becomes sad, consciousness also becomes sad. There's a problem with that perspective, however. Suppose, as your mind became happy, your consciousness simultaneously became happy. Would you be able to detect that your mind was becoming happy if you simultaneously became happy? This is a little... In order to detect something changing, don't you have to be unchanging? In order to observe the changing conditions of your mind, don't you have to be an unchanging observer? The example I've given this before is if you're driving on a freeway and the guy in a car next to you is drinking coffee. He's drinking coffee at 60 miles an hour. Is that what you experience? From your perspective, he is stationary. In order to see him drink coffee at 60 miles an hour, you must be a stationary observer on the side of the road. In the same way, in order to observe the changing moods of your mind, happiness and sadness, in order to observe all that, you, meaning the consciousness which is your true nature, you must necessarily be an unchanging observer. You are the unchanging observer of the changing moods of your mind. Adukam, asukam, that atma. It doesn't get sad, doesn't get happy. That atma happens to be what? Next word, Brahma. The truth of the cosmos, the reality because of which everything exists. That atma is bhuta, bhavya, bhavatmakam. That atma is that which is bhavatmakam, gives existence to bhuta and bhavya, everything that was and will be. That atma gives existence to everything that was and will be. That atma is non-separate from Brahman, the reality because of which all exists. This is the highest teaching of Vedanta. This is what's expressed in the Mahavakya, tat tvam asi. Tvam, you, the truth of you, atma, is non-different from tat, Brahman, the reality because of which everything exists. The reality because of which everything exists is the reality because of which you exist. Atma is not different than Brahman. This is the culminating teaching of Vedanta. And with that statement, Vyasa concludes his lecture to his son. What a lecture. Can you imagine your father giving you this lecture? That would be interesting. I don't think my father would... He didn't understand any of this? Okay. So the remaining, there are just three verses, and the three verses talk about the... It's conventional to end the teaching with some Pala Shruti, some discussion about the benefits of the teaching. So that's what we'll see in the concluding verses. Naitad jnatva pumhan striva, naitad jnatva pumhan striva, punar bhavam avapnuyat, punar bhavam avapnuna, abhava pratipatyartam, abhava pratipatyartam. Etad vartma vidhiyate, etad vartma vidhiyate. Etat jnatva, having understood this, etat jnatva, having understood this teaching about the true self, atma, atma which is utterly unaffected by whatever happens to the body, whatever happens to the mind. Jnatva, having understood that atma, puman striva, whether you are male, female, napumsakova, or neuter, no, whatever the case, na punarbhavam avapnuyat, that na has to get connected to the latter part. Na punarbhavam avapnuyat, one na avapnuyat, one would not gain, na avapnuyat, one would not gain punarbhavam, rebirth. Coming into existence again. One will not get born again. Having made this discovery, one will not get reborn. Now, just to recall that the goal of these spiritual teachings, we define that goal as moksha, freedom. Moksha means freedom. Freedom from what? And this is where it gets a little more complicated, because it's really a twofold freedom. So far, we've been talking about one kind of freedom. When you come to understand that your consciousness is utterly unaffected, your body is decaying, your emotions are going up and down, and your atma consciousness is utterly unaffected, right there is a kind of moksha, a kind of freedom. Freedom from suffering. When your body is decaying, and when you're identified with that body, when you look in the mirror and you say, "Oh my God, that's me. What's happening to me?" When you're identified with your body becomes a source of suffering. We had this discussion long ago where I said, whatever you're identified with becomes an object of suffering. If you're identified with your car, you suffer because of your car. How does that work? When you go to your car, which is parked in a parking lot, and you see a new dent, you get upset. Why? It's just a car with a dent in it. What's the big deal? Oh, Swamiji, it's my car. That's the problem. Whatever you're identified with becomes a source of suffering. You'd think that we have enough sources of suffering in life. We go on finding more. Buy a second car, then you have twice as much suffering. Oh, silly. Anyway, if you're identified with a car, car becomes a source of suffering. If you're identified with your children, you know, many of you know this so well, children are supposed to bring you joy. Not when you're identified with them. The least little thing happens to them, and how do you feel? Oh, God, what will we do? Identified with the children, suffering. Identified with your body, suffering. Identified with the life force, prana, in your body, suffering. Identified with your mind, your intellect, suffering. Identified with your emotions, suffering. Wherever there's identification, there's suffering. The main topic of this chapter has been detachment, or we could say disidentification. When a car is just a car, if it gets a dent, it's a dented car. Where's the problem? No problem. In the same way, If a child is having a problem, who doesn't have problems? You have problems, I have problems, child has problems. It's a fact and not a problem. Look at the difference between a fact and a problem. A fact is a fact. A problem makes you suffer. Similarly, your body. Your body has a physical problem. Is it a problem or is it a fact? If you're detached, if you're disidentified, the physical ailments are facts and not problems. Therefore, there's no suffering, even for the mind and emotions. Sadness is a fact. Sadness need not be a problem. Sadness can be, the metaphor you've heard me give before, like a dark cloud in front of the sun. A dark cloud in front of the sun is a fact. It's not undesirable. It's natural that cloud should come in front of the sun. When that cloud is in front of the sun, of course it's dark and gloomy, but that's normal, isn't it? It's just a fact of nature. And further, you know that that cloud will eventually move on and the sun will shine brightly again. Sadness is no different. Like a dark, gloomy cloud, it's just a fact. And further, you know that that dark, gloomy cloud of sadness will pass on, and that will be that. Sadness is a fact. When sadness is a fact, it's not a source of suffering. This is detachment. Freedom from suffering, then, is one of two kinds of moksha. We said the goal of these spiritual teachings is moksha. Moksha has two aspects. So often we focus on one. What is the aspect we focus on too often? It says so right here. Punar bhavam na avapnuyat. One will not get reborn. So the most common definition of moksha is freedom from getting born again, freedom from rebirth. And there's plenty of scriptural justification and rational justification that, yes, you become free from rebirth when you're enlightened. An enlightened person is not born again. But what about the other moksha? This moksha, moksha meaning freedom from rebirth, this is a benefit. Is just a funny observation. This second kind of moksha, the freedom that you get from rebirth, is a benefit that you only get when you die. This is very much like the, and I'll just put it right out there, this is very much like the biblical concept of salvation. The biblical concept of salvation is there is a spiritual benefit which you can get, but in order to get it, you have to die first. Only after death can you realize that spiritual blessing, salvation. This second meaning of moksha, freedom from rebirth, is very similar, not identical, but it's similar to that biblical concept, in that it is a spiritual benefit that you will not reap until you die. Well, we're not dead yet. We're still dashing, but we're not dead yet. So shouldn't there be some benefit in these teachings to us here and now while we're dashing? Yes. And this is the first meaning of moksha. I should mention that one of the part of the uniqueness of the teachings of Vedanta, Vedanta puts emphasis on this meaning, on the moksha that you enjoy now, the moksha which is freedom from suffering. Many aspects of the Hindu tradition will put emphasis on the latter, on the freedom from rebirth. But one of the unique qualities of the teachings of Vedanta is to emphasize this other meaning, freedom from suffering. It's a freedom that you enjoy here and now. Therefore, in Vedanta, we differentiate between two kinds of moksha. Mukti also means moksha. So we differentiate then between videha mukti and jivan mukti. Videha means without a body. Videha mukti is a kind of moksha you enjoy when you have no body, meaning freedom from rebirth. Na punarjanman punarbhavam avapnuyat. You don't get reborn. But the other aspect, in addition to videha mukti, is jivan mukti. Jivan means while living. Jivan mukti, to enjoy moksha while alive, which means to be utterly free from suffering while you live your life. So this is a reference to the second one, the freedom from rebirth, and it's restated in the second line, abhava pratipatyartam etadvartma. Etadvartma, this path, meaning this spiritual teaching, etadvartma, this spiritual teaching, vidhiyate, establishes what? Abhava pratipatyartam. Establishes the pratipatyartam, the attainment of abhava. And if you're very literal, abhava means non-existence. In this context, it means rebirth. Abhava. Abhava means absence of rebirth, not living again. Abhava pratipatyartam. There's a tongue twister. The attainment of non-rebirth, idam vartma, this path, this teaching, vidyate, establishes. So this verse then talks about the benefit of these teachings that you reap after you're dead. But most of the chapter has been concerned with what? What happens while you're still alive? Reflect on that. This teaching about videha mukti comes at the very end of the chapter, and really just in one verse. The rest of the chapter is devoted to jivan mukti, freedom from suffering while alive. All right. Then. Yatha matani sarvani, yatha matani sarvani, na chaitani yatha tata, na chaitani yatha tata, katitani maya putra, katitani maya, bhavanti na bhavanti cha, bhavanti. Yatha matani sarvani cha etani. Etani, sarvani, matani. In this world, there are many of these, etani, sarvani, all of them, all of what? Matani. Different teachings, different opinions, different ways of thinking, different attitudes, different perspectives. So we've been talking about the perspective from the top of the mountain. But there are many other perspectives in life. There's a perspective of... Sorry, this is just for fun. One perspective is from the top of the mountain. Another perspective is in front of your television set. Another perspective is in a restaurant. Another perspective is in a movie theater. These are different perspectives on life. And it's really quite a valid metaphor. Which is your perspective? Which is your main perspective? In front of the TV or up on top of the mountain? So here, Vyasa, concluding the chapter, he says, there are so many perspectives in life. Mata here, meaning perspective. There are so many perspectives in life. Natata katitani maya putra. Putra, o son. But all these other opinions and perspectives in life are natata katitani maya. They are unlike what I've been teaching you. Katitani, the teachings, what I've been teaching maya, what has been taught by me, what I have been teaching you, putra, O son, is utterly unlike those conventional attitudes in life. How true it is. Conventional attitudes in life, conventional perspectives in life is a perspective of sitting in front of the TV, sitting in the movie theater, sitting in front of your computer. These are the conventional perspectives in life. But what Vyasa is teaching here is that perspective from the mountaintop, a perspective where you see the entire span of life, a perspective from which you see the true value and meaning of life. But all those other perspectives, he concludes, bhavanti na bhavanti cha. Those perspectives can sometimes, bhavanti, very, very loose language here. Those perspectives may lead you to something nice, something that you want, bhavanti. Some happiness may take place, na bhavanti cha, or may not. The other perspectives may or may not give happiness to you, but those perspectives are utterly unlike what Vyasa has been teaching his son, Shuka. The perspective Vyasa teaches is the one from the top of the mountain. And the final verse of the chapter, we go into the longer Trishtub Chandas here, the longer meter here. Tat priti yuktena gunan vatena. Tat priti yuktena gunan vatena. Putrena sat putra gunan vatena. Putrena sat putra gunan vatena. Prishto hidam priti matahitartam. Prishto hidam priti matahitartam. Bruyat sutasyeha yaduktametata. Bruyat sutasyeha yaduktametata. Start in the second line. Prishtaha. Prishta. When asked. Talking about Vyasa has been teaching his son. Why has Vyasa been teaching his son all of this? I'm not sure, in this chapter or prior chapter. Sure enough. How did this chapter begin? Shuka uvacha. The chapter began with Shuka's question. So sometimes fathers just lecture you whether you want to hear or not. In this case, Shuka asked this question. And his question, yasmat dharmat paro dharma, what is the greatest dharma at all? Dharma of all. Yaha vishishtam dharmebhyaha. What is the greatest dharma of all? What is the most important spiritual teaching of all? This is how the chapter began. So, when you are prishtaha, when you have been asked such a profound question, asked by whom, go to the first line now, asked by tat priti yuktena gunan vitena putrena, asked putrena by a son who is tat priti yuktena, filled with love for his father. How nice. Tat priti yuktena, endowed with great love for his father. Gunan vatena, endowed with all good qualities. All sons should be like this. Not like me. We do the best we can. So when a son is tat priti yuktena, endowed with great love with his father, for his father, when a son is gunan vatena, endowed with great qualities, when that son is sat putra gunan vatena, when a son is endowed with the qualities, guna anvita, you have to break the words apart, anvita means endowed with the gunas, the qualities, and what kind of qualities? The qualities of a satputra, good son. So when a son is endowed with the qualities of a good son, and when you are prishtaha, when you have been asked this very profound question by such a son, then what should you do? He, indeed, idam hitartam, these teachings, for the hitartam, for the sake of blessing your son, these teachings, bruyat, should be told, should be taught. Should be taught unto whom? Sutasya, unto the son. These teachings should be taught unto that son. Iha, here and now, yadukta metat, all that I have taught should be taught. All that I have already taught is what should be taught unto a son, such a good son, a son filled with love and good qualities. It should all be taught bruyat, hitartham, for the sake of blessing the son, and should be taught how or by whom? Priti mata, by a father who has great love for his son. So with this verse, Vyasa brings the chapter to an end, this chapter in which he gives these very profound spiritual teachings to his son. Of course, it's like we're all kind of looking over Shuka's shoulder, as it were, listening to these teachings. So we're also blessed by these teachings. But what great love of father for son. And in a broader sense, here we have, we can understand our scriptures not as a father, but as a mother. Shruti is a word we use for our scriptures. Happens to be strilinga, happens to be a feminine noun. So we look upon all of our scriptures as shruti mata, as mother in a form of scriptures. And mother in a form of scriptures is blessing all of us with these very profound teachings to help us gain freedom from suffering here in this very life. So this brings our current chapter to the end. We're in the midst of this 24-chapter dialogue between Vyasa and his son Shuka, and we're going to take one more chapter from that dialogue, the very last chapter. So when we meet next time, we'll take up that very last chapter, which is part of that dialogue. And before we conclude our class, some very important announcements. Tomorrow, Sunday, we'll have our satsang at 6 p.m. And I think after the anniversary also, we'll just let the satsang continue. So those of you who are free, anytime, any Sunday, 6 p.m., come for satsang. With the weather getting nicer, we'll probably have satsang outside, and we may even be able to take a walk in the woods on some nice Sunday evening. So come join us for satsang. Then, of course, a week from today is our annual anniversary celebration, our 11th anniversary. So please come. The meditation class and this class will not take place, but we'll have a wonderful celebration planned starting at 10 o'clock. So please come at 10. The program will start with some nice music. We have some dignitaries who will give some talks. I mentioned before that Pooja Swami Dayananda sent a video message for us. He was very kind to do that. So we'll enjoy his video message, and I'll have a nice talk for you. So please plan on coming next Sunday. Also, then we'll have a nice picnic lunch. We'll go outside, hope for good weather. We'll go outside and we'll have a very nice lunch. We have it's all catered. We'll have some very nice food. It'll be nice just once in a year to celebrate together another year of our ashram's activities. To help get ready for the program, this coming Friday evening, we're going to have some volunteer work. Those of you who are free, please come. We have to set up the hall. We have to do some setup outside. Then we have to do some preparation. We usually get about 400 or more people for the celebration, so we have to do a few things to get ready for everyone to come. So please come on Friday evening at 6:30. And if you're coming from work, if you come a little late, that's fine. Come as soon as you can. But the main work will begin here at 6:30. We're going to be putting chairs out. We're going to be putting tables up. A lot of just carrying things around, mostly. Please come. We'll also be serving some dinner afterwards, since many of you will be coming right from work. So please come at 6:30, then maybe an hour or so of setup, followed by dinner, and then we'll be ready for our celebration on Saturday morning. Very good. We'll conclude with our prayers and our tea.